You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello from Midori House in London, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show, John Owen and Daniela Peled will be here to go through the biggest stories of the day from Egypt to Saudi Arabia and Romania. Then we'll continue our Italian series by praising an unsung hero of the nation's manufacturing, Naples.
When you read Kimbo, you perceive coffee espresso from Naples. Over 50 years, this has been done, and we're trying to expand this all over the world.
Plus, we're back at the world's biggest retail fair, Euroshop, in Dusseldorf, with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards. Today, we hear from designer Harry Tyler. And the Parisian duo Tin there will review sounds from all around the world with Nick Luscombe, founder of Musicity. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, right now. So plenty coming up in the next half hour, well, the next hour even here on Midori House. But before all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
An asylum seeker has been killed and 77 others injured in rioting at one of Australia's immigration detention centres in Papua New Guinea. There have been two nights of rioting after some of the detainees briefly escaped from the detention centre on Manus Island. The Australian Immigration Minister is Scott Morrison.
People choose to remove themselves from that centre, then they're obviously putting themselves at a place of much greater risk. And in an environment like that, where there is violent behaviour on the part of those who are breaching the perimeter fence and going out of the centre, then this is a disorderly environment in which there is always great risk.
In Thailand, the country's anti-corruption body has just announced that it was filing charges against the Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra relating to a rice subsidy scheme that has fueled middle-class opposition to her government. Anti-government protesters in the capital Bangkok, led by a former deputy premier Suthep Thaksuban, have forced Yingluck to abandon her offices in Government House. The National Anti-Corruption Commission announced it was summoning Yingluck on the 27th of February to hear charges against her. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu voiced confidence that world demand for Israel's technology will enable his country to outflank pro-Palestinian groups advocating its economic boycott. He was referring to the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement sponsored by pro-Palestinian intellectuals and bloggers, which campaigns for a blanket boycott of all Israeli goods and even questions Israel's legitimacy.
I think the most eerie thing, the most disgraceful thing, is to have people on the soil of Europe talking about the boycott of Jews. I think that's an outrage. That is something that we're re-encountering. In the past, anti-Semites boycotted Jewish businesses, and today they call for the boycott of the Jewish state.
Ukrainian riot police have advanced to the heart of 12-week-old protests against President Viktor Yanukovych. Security forces in Ukraine have set a deadline to end disturbances after at least five protesters were reportedly killed in a day of clashes. The Brazilian soccer star Pelé has told an audience in Egypt that everyone should go to Brazil this year to see them win the World Cup. The 73-year-old triple World Cup winner is in Egypt promoting an international youth soccer tournament and attended the opening ceremony at the Giza Pyramids. The winner of the tournament will travel to Rio de Janeiro to attend the opening ceremony of the 2014 FIFA World Cup in June.
I thank you for the love of the people who received me here. Then I take the opportunity, yes, we're going to talk football. We are close from the World Cup in Brazil.
Yeah.
I take the opportunity to invite everyone to come to be my guest in Brazil and to see Brazil win the World Cup.
And finally, lace underwear is to be banned in Russia, Belarus and Kazakhstan. The import, production or sale of synthetic lingerie will be prohibited under new trade laws which start in July. Russia's lingerie outlets will have to throw away as much as 90% of their stock. Some women protesters in Kazakhstan have been, metaphorically speaking, getting their knickers in a twist over the proposed ban and have now been detained. And that's latest news from Monocle 24.
That's a very Jonathan Wheatley final story there. He likes things like that. Jonathan will be back with more news, both serious and perhaps a little bit entertaining in 30 minutes. Right now, though, you're listening to Mindori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
And you are listening to Mindori House, and the time in London now is 18.06, which means it's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Daniela Pellet of the Institute of War and Peace Reporting, and John Owen, chairman of the Frontline Club and professor of international journalism at City University London. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to start today in Egypt, where the situation is becoming increasingly tense. The Sinai-based Islamist group Ansar Bayat al-Mahdi's has warned tourists to leave the country before it is too late, threatening to attack anyone who remains there after February 20. The group has claimed responsibility for a suicide bomb attack that took the lives of two South Korean tourists and an Egyptian on Sunday. While the Muslim Brotherhood has been crushed since the ousting of President Mohamed Morsi, Ansar Bayat al-Mahdi's has become increasingly bold in its actions. Let's come to you first, Daniela. What do we know about this organisation and its intent?
Well, we know that of the, I think there's been about 300 attacks in Sinai since the military coup last summer, and this group has claimed most of them. They seem fairly sophisticated. They managed to carry out a string of attacks on police officers in the autumn, not just in Sinai, but in Cairo, in the north of the country. Most worryingly, I think, they managed to down a Egyptian military helicopter in January, which shows quite an escalation of their manpower. They used a manpad, which is a surface-to-air missile, which is a pretty deadly weapon, probably came from Libya. So I think that in itself is a threat to Cairo. Also, the Israelis are very worried about it too.
And just tell me, before I bring in John, you know, these organisations, we often hear about them and we imagine them to be sometimes tight organisations, and they are, and other times they seem to be a bit, you know, more like Al-Qaeda, more kind of affiliates and collectives and groups of people kind of signing themselves up to a name. In this instance, is there any kind of evidence of how organised they are?
Well, it's hard to tell because Sinai has always been very lawless, and the Bedouin have really very much been a law unto themselves and been very unhappy with central government for as long as there has been central government in Egypt. With this particular group, as far as I understand it, that some disgruntled Bedouins, some disgruntled Egyptians, but also some fighters from abroad, some global jihadists who've travelled to Sinai to take part in this.
Now, John, the tourism trade is of vital importance to Egypt. And I think, you know, over the years there have been attacks on tourists and, you know, and people have come back again and again. But over the years, the numbers have dwindled badly. And this is one of the few lifelines in a country that needs the cash.
Exactly right. And this is a point that journalists from this country and other countries are trying to make to Egyptian officials when they talk about the plight, for example, of the Al Jazeera journalist being held in prison, coming to trial on Thursday, that the more they do things that are spotlighting how unsafe and dangerous it is for journalists to go in and tell stories about Luxor, about how you can go travel safely, and then we have incidents like the one that just happened. Why would you right now book a trip to Egypt, and why would you as a journalist feel you wouldn't be arrested if you made a difficult choice to talk to somebody affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood?
Daniel. Yeah, there was a very interesting Tumblr blog last year titled Egyptians Photographing Foreigners, which was Egyptians taking pictures of foreigners because it was such an unusual thing to see across Egypt. And most of these photographs they were taking were of journalists. I mean, that just shows you how terrible situation the tourism trade finds itself in, especially in Sinai. I mean, I have very happy memories of delightful holidays in Sinai, you know, in the resort, in Dahab, in little tiny huts on the beach. And I'm not usually too nervous about going places slightly off the track. Well, I wouldn't take my family there now.
I was going to say, some of those places like Sharm el-Sheikh, they're still kind of, you know, Hurghada, they're still kind of diving centres. They're still trying to pull in tourists. And they were once kind of places where the Israelis felt very comfortable to go, only like, you know, maybe like 10, 15 years ago, they were still welcome there and they still felt comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of the Israelis don't tend to take very much attention when they're told not to go places. They were told not to go to Turkey. They were told not to go to Sinai. They still went. Now things are different. I wouldn't go to Sinai. It was as beautiful as it is.
And also, it also shows the economy spiraling out of control. A very big, long piece in the New York Times about how many unemployed there are in Egypt and all the young men who are looking for work and women. So it's spiraling badly.
But, just picking up on your point, and I know it's an issue that concerns you greatly, what's happening to the Al Jazeera journalists and this trial that's pending. If you were kind of playing devil's advocate on the other side, would the Egyptians say, well, look, here's the evidence. You know, we have these bomb attacks going off in our country. We don't know what's going on. There's all sorts of foreigners coming across the border. We're not in a position where we can trust anybody unless they're upfront about who they are and they give us their papers and they register. Do you think, you know, that there is some legitimacy, you see, that they should be concerned about who's crossing their borders if those people are coming in without the right paperwork?
Well, that is a point of contention. I mean, Al Jazeera and those who are trying to explain away what happened are saying it was an administrative oversight, that there was someone already working for another channel that was moving to Al Jazeera as a freelancer. That doesn't excuse it. Another argument from the Egyptians is, well, they were working in hotels. Well, a lot of people work in hotels because it's safer, the food is better, and they won't have their bureaus raided the way the Egyptians did. I think it's legitimate to raise questions about trying to make sure that people are not imposters as journalists, but you don't throw them into prison, whether you're a blogger or a journalist, for talking to the opposition and doing what journalism is supposed to be doing, not campaigning for the other side. If the Egyptians feel strongly enough about the biased coverage, then appeal to Arab-speaking writing individuals to monitor the coverage and then say, look, we think it's biased. You know, we would like to hear what you think. And there is a view, many people think, who look at the coverage, that it has crossed the line in places at times.
Daniel, just before we move on, it's interesting, this bomb attack, you know, that it did get a little bit of coverage, but actually it hasn't had that much coverage. It's not like when there's, I guess, is it just because they weren't Europeans or Americans that were killed? It doesn't seem to have made the headlines in quite the way that you'd imagined this story. It's kind of been there on kind of like page, you know, 15, but it hasn't exactly been on the front pages of the press here.
I think also it's because it's a place where tourists aren't going already. If it had happened in a desperately popular resort somewhere in Europe, it would be big news. But look, there was 30-odd passengers on the bus. A bus bombing like that could have killed most of them. It didn't. You know, a handful of people were killed, some were injured. There were tourists not from Europe. So the warning for tourists not to go to a place where tourists are already not going, you know, it hasn't had as much of an impact as it might have done.
Well, another tragic story from a country certainly going through some terrible machinations. But we're going to move on now to Romania, because partly John is interested in this topic, and we all are. He's just literally come back from Romania. And I know, John, you're very interested in the issue of the Roma, and it's a story that you've been following, and you've built up some personal interest in this story. Could you tell us, first of all, why you went and what you found?
Well, I went to pursue a story that I don't want to say too much about right now, but it's looking into what were charges brought against an individual, a Romanian or a Roma, who eventually did plead guilty to charges of defrauding the British government, served time in Holloway Prison. And there's good reason to believe that the charges that were brought because she was Roma, and also because there was some kind of operation going on between Romanian and Metropolitan London Police that perhaps she was caught up in, not correctly, that she was innocent in those charges. But it has a lot to do with also the way the media portrayed this individual. I mean, so I'm looking into that as well. And there's some very good investigative journalists based in Bucharest. But while there, spent a lot of time talking to a lot of people about the issue that we read hear so much about here, and that is, are the Romanians, the Bulgarians coming to steal jobs away from the British?
Daniel, your image of the Roma, I think for all of us, you know, you are fed a kind of very simple diet of what the Roma are about. You know, certainly the coverage we see here in the UK, and that there is a confusion between the Romans and the Roma, of course, the Romanians rather than the Roma. But the images we see often of Roma, it's to do with begging. It's to do with, you know, children being forced out on the street. Do you feel that it is one of the great kind of prejudices that has filtered through all the papers, and somehow every nation kind of gets away with it?
Well, look at what we've had in Britain. My big fat gypsy wedding. I mean, the travelling community here have kind of been a bit better rebranded than the Roma in Romania. But in my visits to Romania, I found myself shocked, really, by the visible poverty of the Roma. The neighbourhoods, I visited neighbourhoods in Bucharest that where my family came from, a Jewish family, before the war, now populated by Roma, really, really downtrodden, you know, immense poverty. Are things changing now that they've joined the European Union? I think a little bit more Roma are willing to identify themselves as Roma, because I think, as I understand it, the numbers are hugely, hugely much lower. I think there's about 600,000 Roma in Romania. The numbers, the real figures are much higher. But I think the Romanians don't really want to tackle this issue for domestic reasons. And am I being unfair in thinking that the Roma are a convenient scapegoat for them, really?
Yeah, I mean, to pick up your point, by the way, there are prominent Roma who are moving upwards in politics. There are prominent Roma who are, of course, members of prominent orchestras all throughout Europe. But there is also Ferrantari, and that's what you're thinking about, the worst squalor that you could possibly see, open dumps, children living next to these vacant buildings, drugs, crime. They're not coming, by the way, to take British jobs because they're so poor they can barely move out of what really is a ghetto in the best American tradition. There were like big projects I used to see in Chicago when I was a reporter. They're not coming. I think the people who might come to take jobs, Roma and Romanians, are people who migrate, who look for opportunities here to take low-paying jobs that British don't want to take and others, and they will come, but they'll go back. I didn't hear much about Roma or Romanians wanting to come here and stay. They want to make money, exploit the higher pay wage here, and then go home, because there are a lot of really exciting things going on in Romania and Bucharest.
What's happening in Romania is happening, obviously, in Hungary as well. You know, there is huge communities in the east that, you know, are not being given access to education and healthcare in the way that they should be. And we see places like France, you know, desperate to kind of send back anybody who they believe is Roma. But do you think that you touched on a very interesting point, and I wonder whether we do need to hear the stories, not just of, like, you know, the good Roma, as it were, but of people doing interesting things who are Roma. It's somehow we just don't tell those people's stories.
I think that's bad journalism. I mean, I think we're all guilty of that, too. I mean, it's so easy to go in and look for that stereotype story. But I met, through this good friend contact of mine, I met, you know, a woman who's a psychotherapist and working all over Europe. I met somebody else who's a consultant working with all kinds of educational projects. Another guy who's just started a new Roma museum that is opening up, doesn't have all of its exhibits there, but I toured it. It's going to be fantastic. So there are positive things happening. And I think that's one thing, you know, Monocle does. I use the Monocle magazine as my little guide to Bucharest, and I found the best cappuccino I've found in a long time.
We've tried to tell some surprising stories about Romania. I also have a very good friend here in the UK whose father was Roma, and the best story he ever told me was when he was like 5 or 6, he was so good at riding ponies that he could kind of win the Gymkhana, but he never had any shoes on, so they were always really angry at having to give him the cup at the end of the race. But anyway, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Daniela Pellid and John Owen. And when we return, we'll discuss the appointment of a woman to the helm of the first Saudi newspaper.
The Singapore Air Show is a magnet for the world's most important aerospace companies, all of them eager to sell to the high-flying Asia-Pacific market. Monocle got strapped in to gauge the state of the soaring industry.
The requirements for new military equipment here are vast and include not only combat and surveillance aircraft, but tankers and transports as well. Patrolling maritime borders was, however, one of the more dominant themes, and that's no surprise given current tensions in the region.
Pushing Tin at the 2014 Singapore Air Show, premiering in the Films menu on Monocle.com.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Daniela Pellet from the Institute of War and Peace Reporting and John Owen, chairman of the Frontline Club. Now, time to discuss some rare good news for women in Saudi Arabia. Samaya Jabati is about to become the first female editor-in-chief of a Saudi publication, the English-speaking paper Saudi Gazette. Her successor, Khaled Al-Aina, wrote on Sunday's edition of the Gazette that she'd earned the position on merit, praising her dedication. Jabati herself says that she feels a great responsibility for other women in her country. Yet, as some critics have noted, though she is at the helm of a national publication, she still can't drive herself to work. Daniela, what do you make of this appointment? Do you think, you know, we are trying to see some attempts by the Saudi authorities to kind of make this kind of odd world where you definitely can't drive, you definitely can't do all these things over here, but in the world of work, we will begin to open up some access for opportunity, especially if you're in a women-only environment. Is it a breakthrough or is it a little piece of kind of window dressing in a way?
Well, I don't want to pour water on her achievements, but I think the significance is zero, really. In fact, less than zero. In fact, negative. Because, again, I mean, I'm sure that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia's public diplomacy department must be seizing on this. Like, look, great, this is a great news story. But what's the significance? I mean, the significance is the same as the fact that the majority of graduates from Saudi universities are women. But so what? They can't go into the job market. I mean, it's pretty hard to go into the job market when you can't drive yourself to work, you can't move around freely, you can't travel without a male family member's permission. So the significance is not great. I mean, on an individual level, this is great. I've worked with a lot of very impressive journalists from across the Middle East and the Arab world, from Afghanistan, Yemen, places where women do not have an easy time of it. So their individual achievements, great. Wider significance, not so much.
I mean, the issue that IWPR knows better than anybody is self-censorship. So, again, you can be the editor of any paper anywhere, but if you know what you can't do when you walk in to assign your stories, that's really the issue. I've had several Saudi women student journalists at City University, and it was fascinating to see when they had a chance to write papers on subjects that they knew would never be allowed to be published back in Saudi. They wrote about things, again, that you would never be able to assign to a reporter. So let's wish her luck, but I think as long as the system is as it is, I don't think there's going to be much daring journalism. Let's remind ourselves that in the latest INSEE figures out today, local journalists who pursue crime and violence get killed. And I don't know that an editor in Saudi is going to take those kind of risks.
I see that she did write an essay which was imagining the world in the year 3000. And she thought then that Saudi women might be able to drive. That's quite a long time to, there may be no cars left or any fuel left by then. But so it's certainly a long time to wait. But when we look across the whole, of the Arab world, you don't see that many prominent women journalists, I guess, in Egypt or in Algeria or any of these places, do you?
I mean, I don't know about prominent. I've met a lot of them, and IWPR, we work with a lot of them. And I'm hugely impressed by the determination and the kind of work they do. This is great on an individual level. This is great on an institutional level. You know, the newspaper in question in Saudi Arabia, most of the journalists are women. The senior management are men. And that it's limiting and self-limiting the kind of stories that they can do. So I'm afraid,
I did have a look at a copy of it today, and the journalism is a bit kind of local news, incredibly.
And pictures of royal family on the front cover.
Yeah, there are a few pictures of the royal family. And there was mainly kind of looking at kind of foreign stories in a very modest way as well. There was very little to kind of upset anyone, I think, at all. Now, we'll move on, because before we go, we couldn't help but discuss perhaps the most ridiculous aspect of yesterday's plane hijacking, of which there were several, including the fact the gentleman who hijacked it was in charge of it. But anyway, the Swiss Air Force have said that they did not respond to the hijacking over their airspace by the pilot of the Ethiopian Airlines flight because it happened outside normal business hours. Indeed, Swiss fighter jets are only operational from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. and they even stop for lunch. For budget reasons, Swiss politicians from all sides of the political spectrum have called for a 24-hour operation. But until now, Switzerland has relied on its international allies, the armed forces of Italy, France and Germany. John, you're shaking your head. What do you make of the Swiss?
I can't. I'm going to defer. I'm passing this potato.
Daniela?
Or watch. Well, I'm passing this
Swiss watch. I actually had the pleasure of making the acquaintance of a Swiss Air Force pilot once. And he seemed to spend most of his time doing loop-the-loops and a bit of fun flying and then quite a lot of skiing in his spare time. I don't think the idea of active service really came on the horizon, so to speak. I mean, to be fair to Switzerland, which is not something that I would usually be inclined to be, but it is a tiny country. You could fly over it in a matter of minutes. You know, to have an effective air force that could scramble so quickly would really have to be a big operation. And let's face it,
perhaps they need some foreign pilots. Yeah. That's what they really need. Oh no, they just had a bit of a referendum, didn't they? That's not going to happen. We did do a pretty good story on the Swiss military where we went and hung out with them. They have their own amazing kind of Swiss military cookbook, which they all follow. So they get nice Bersham usually in the morning. And
you should be talking to your editor-in-chief. He seems to know quite a bit about Switzerland.
I think he knows quite a bit about Switzerland. He's also quite an avid plane spotter. So I think he would probably know when their jets had taken off. Just coming back to the issue, though, of hijackings, it was the other unusual aspect of it. I think they're quite rare these days, aren't they? It's not a kind of a very good way of getting your story across. And there's not really, you just don't hear about them in the way that they used to. I guess the security is much better these days.
Yeah, I think after 9/11, you stand the risk, apart from if you're in Switzerland, of being shot down rather before you had a chance of making your demands felt.
And this gentleman also, he managed to kind of hijack his own plane. The great thing was he climbed out a ladder all on his own. There was no way. They're probably going to invite him around for a fondue session, I think. But then he got arrested, poor thing, even when he could have arrived there safely. Well, I think we'll have to probably leave the Swiss a little bit on their own. Just before we go, John, next for you, you've been out to Romania. What happens next with the story? You'll be pursuing it here in the UK?
Well, going to pursue it both in this country and in Romania. And, there's a very, very good investigative journalist who runs a data center in Bucharest, and he tracks data and the way police work and looks at corruption throughout the Balkans. You probably have worked with him, Paul Radu. And he's an interesting guy to talk to and to see what he knows. And there are a lot of people who know a lot more than we appear to know at this point about that story.
And Dana, your connection with Bucharest will continue?
I wouldn't mind going back and seeing what's happened since my last visit, where I thought it looked a bit like a post-apocalyptic Paris, is my recollection.
Well, it's not somewhere I've been. Well, thank you both for coming in. I'm just seeing you again very shortly anyway. That was Daniela Pellid from the Institute of War and Peace Reporting and John Owen, chairman of the Frontline Club here in London. And thank you to both of them for joining us here today.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
От Лондон, това е Monocle 24.
Фра Лондон, дете е Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda,
London, Europe,
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
This is Monocle 24.
Well, don't go away, because there's plenty going to happen in the second half of the show here on Midori House. And we're going to head to a coffee factory in Naples for part two of our Italy series.
When you read Kimbo, you perceive coffee espresso from Naples. Over 50 years, this has been done, and we're trying to expand this all over the world.
And we're also going to be at the world's biggest retail fair with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards. But before we get started on all of that and have our espresso, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Thanks very much. In Thailand, the country's anti-corruption body has just announced that it was filing charges against the Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra relating to a rice subsidy scheme that has fueled middle-class opposition to her government. Anti-government protesters in the capital, Bangkok, led by the former deputy Premier Suthep Thaksaban, have forced Yingluck to abandon her offices in Government House. An asylum seeker has been killed and 77 others injured in rioting at one of Australia's immigration detention centres in Papua New Guinea. There have been 2 days of rioting after some of the detainees briefly escaped from the detention centre. Ukrainian riot police have advanced to the heart of 12-week-old protests against President Viktor Yanukovych. Security forces in Ukraine have set a deadline to end disturbances after now 9 protesters were reportedly killed in a day of clashes. And the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has voiced confidence that world demand for Israel's technology will enable his country to outflank pro-Palestinian groups which are advocating Israel's economic boycott. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. I think he may return to the pants story in 30 minutes. So breaking news, anybody worried about their knicker elastic out east? That was Jonathan Wheatley. The time now is 18:31 here in London, which means it's 20:31 in Moscow and 16:31 in Rio de Janeiro. And to coincide with the launch of Monocle Magazine's Italian special, that's our March issue, every day this week on Midori House, we'll be opening up the magazine and taking some of the stories and topics and giving them a bit of a Monocle 24 treatment. Today, we turn to the business pages, which gave particular attention to an unsung hero of Italian manufacturing, Naples, as well as yacht makers, an octogenarian umbrella maker, an internationally renowned tailor, and an iconic chocolate factory. Monocle's associate producer and in-house Italian expert went to the factory of Kimbo, Italy's second largest coffee maker and a familiar brand in the kitchens and supermarkets of the country. David Pleasant found out just how the coffee is processed and tested, but also how the Kimbo brand is capitalising on its Italian and Neapolitan connections.
I'm standing right here in the centre of the factory floor at Kimbo, which is at Melito di Napoli, just outside Naples. The factory is extremely clean and surprisingly high-tech. There are robotic arms lifting batches of freshly packed coffee onto crates. Above me, there are several giant silos containing different coffee beans. These are roasted and ground to different degrees and then are packed by this impressive machine I'm standing right by. Thousands of red and white Kimbo packs are flying past me every second on dozens of conveyor belts. Now I'm going to go and speak to Kimbo's boss.
Kimbo is some sort of historic company that was born something like 50 years ago in the city. 50 years ago, meaning 1963, was a time in which Italy was developing a lot. And as a matter of fact, the founders of the company were so, to some sort, lucky and so clever to create right away a brand, the Kimbo brand, that was made for people living in Naples. But suddenly they understood that the flavor of this special coffee in a developing country, Italy was very much developing at that time, was something that could have a big success. So they made a move to advertise this type of coffee made in Naples to the rest of Italy. So that the success was so impressive to such an extent that from then on, the espresso coffee was identified with Neapolitan coffee.
So Kimbo is clearly an iconic Italian coffee brand. This, as for any big company, also has its challenges. How does Kimbo market and innovate its product without damaging any of the positive brand associations?
Let's say that when you are a brand, you got to make sure that when someone looks at the brand, he gets right away the feeling of what it is, okay? Obviously, to make sure that a brand, to reach a given brand awareness in the country, you have to work years and years and you have to invest a lot of money. If you, as you probably know, we're active in different market segments. We're active in the HoReCa sector, that means bars and the restaurants and things like that, but we're also active into the distribution to the retailer shop. Retailer means that you reach all the families all over here. Consider that we have a production of coffee in this site over here of 23 million kilos. Consider that in Italy we have 60 million people living in the country. Looks like that 50% of the people are doing at least getting at least 1 kilo of coffee from this company. That's a good reaching for the people. And obviously, we try to keep a consistency into the brand. The brand is very simple. It's the name of the company in red, and that's it. We don't put any information regarding the product or so, because we believe that the brand awareness is such that we don't need to give the people the feeling that it's a coffee or it's something else. We do coffee. When you read Kimbo, you perceive coffee, espresso from Naples. Luckily, over 50 years, this has been done. And we're trying to expand this all over the world. So in different countries, we're trying to put the same type of look and feel regarding this type of coffee.
Kimbo is confident and self-assured when it comes to promoting its brand around the world. It certainly is in a great position to do so, with a familiar and trusted position on the Italian market. But brand confidence has to come with absolute confidence in the product. I'm now crossing the factory floor and going over to the other side of the plant to meet a woman who certainly knows her coffee very well.
Buongiorno, io sono Maria.
Good morning, my name is Maria Cristina Ciccarico, and I'm quality manager for Kimbo. Right here is where we have the tasting tests for all our blends, whether they're in the creation phase or in the production phase. This tasting phase represents a vital step in the commercial progress of the end product. We regularly form a panel group to taste and detect characteristics of the coffee. These people are either internal experts who work with us in the lab or external people brought in especially. So we bring in buyers and retailers. This helps us get a panoramic view of not only our technical feedback, but more importantly, the perception of our product by our consumers.
Una classica seduta di assaggio e di controllo, quindi, dei nostri caffè.
A classic sitting of coffee tasting involves a blind tasting. So a series of coffees are prepared and put in front of our judges. Our judges are here to determine the characteristics of the coffee from a single small cup. They are also looking out for taste associations and different qualities. If there are deviations or anomalies to the taste of the coffee, it will not be used commercially.
I'm intrigued. So what makes for an anomalous cup of coffee, as it all smells so delicious?
One of the anomalous characteristics of coffee is that it can be astringent and have a mouth-drying effect, or that it can have bitter tones.
Well, I'm glad we've got that straight. Heaven forbid that Italians are waking up to an astringent cup of coffee in the morning. But how about the business of coffee? Where does Kimbo go next? Back to Simone Cavallo.
I have a few numbers in front of me. I mean, if I consider in volume, because volumes are the real, let's say, indicator, is the real indicator of if the companies are growing or not growing. If I consider volumes, we grew 7.6% in 2013 compared to the previous year. This is overall. If I consider the foreign market, we grew 10.2%. That means that the acceleration in growth in the export market is much bigger than what we do in Italy. Overall, the company is growing a lot. This means that when there is a crisis, quality pays. That means that the coffee is a sort of premium that a single family or a person gives to yourself. If you go to a bar, to a coffee shop or whatever, you pay €1 for a coffee, but you want a good coffee. And this means that there are a lot of coffee shops that are starting to prefer good quality coffee because this pays. And we try to continue on this road.
Well, that was our very own David Pleasant speaking to Managing Director of Cafe Kimbo, Simone Cavallo, in Naples. Stay tuned. Up next, we're reviewing the most exciting international tracks of the week. Oh, yes, we are. And we also check in with our team at Euroshop, the world's biggest retail fair.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push, maybe, that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And welcome back to Midori House. It's currently 18:40 here in London. And now? Well, now we're off to Dusseldorf, of course, where the world's largest retail fair, Euroshop, is underway. Tyler Brulet and Tom Edwards are there to find out how the innovators, originators and creative minds at the event are renewing the industry. Let's hear how their second day at the expo has gone. Over to you, Tom.
Yes, indeed. We are still here at Euroshop in Dusseldorf. I'm alongside Tyler Brulet, our editor-in-chief, and my companion here at...
For the last 2 days, which has been
on the Schweizer stand. It's been pretty good. We've had some fine food and drink, as well as seeing a lot of the most extraordinary retail trends. Let's talk a little bit, though, about the design element, the kind of pure design, because it's interesting that it's not just about functionality here, far from it. These surroundings tell you great design is fundamental. You've been struck, I know, particularly with the sort of Sub Tirol influence here, some of the beautiful wood. How much of a space do you think there is for great design? Do you think there's more opportunities, or there should be more opportunities for design purists to get involved in the retail environment?
I mean, for sure, not to be rude about some of the other booths, and there are many hundreds, so no one will sort of feel singled out, but you do walk the aisles of this fair, and there's some really shocking stands, you know, companies which are selling quite toxic looking shop fit outs, you know, and be that for, you know, a shoe store or a hair salon or whatever it is, but you can just tell, like, just, you know, the paints, the materials, everything that goes into it, it all just seems sort of very, very wrong. You also touched on the environment that we're in. What's lovely about this, all larch wood, just, you know, wonderfully scented. I mean, it's probably not as fragrant as it was when they put it up. But then it's also great. There's this banquette running around the entire space that we're in, Tom, and it's all in local Loden as well, which is really beautiful. And I think one thing that you touched on yesterday, which was interesting, is you know, how do you go to be, and how do you bring your brand to be sort of big and international? How do you work with a company like this one? But if you have global ambitions, you know, how do you also maintain that degree of authenticity? How are you able to support small craftsmen? So I think even it's interesting with Schweitzer as well, is, you know, they've worked with Harry Thaler, for example, who is, you know, a small player as a designer, but he's made a very big contribution to the stand. So, you know, this company can work with the likes of Victoria's Secret, but then they can also support small designers as well.
And tell us a bit more about Harry Thaler, because I actually caught up with him a little earlier, and we'll hear from him in a moment or two. But tell me about his MO, because he has a fine eye. It's a lot of wood, a lot of fine detail, a lot of kind of traditional design craftsmanship, I guess. That's some of his watchwords.
I mean, he's a designer. He's based in Murano. So Murano is about a 10-minute, 15-minute drive from Naturns, which is where Schweitzer is based. I stumbled across Harry's work. We'd covered him a couple of times in the magazine, but he did this wonderful project called Pure Sud Tirol, which is, what would your ideal grocery store be? What would the shopping cart look like? Would it be sort of this, like, perfect little woven basket on twig-like legs? Probably would, wouldn't it?
That's described it almost to a T.
And would it also serve amazing coffee? And could you buy great wine and local organic beer and a range of fantastic apple juices? And also great things to take home. That's what he's created. And now this has gone beyond Murano. It's opened up in another city. Also in Sud Tirol, it's going to be in Bolzano soon. Harry is, you know, he's done some great retail work, but he is, in many ways, he's not just an industrial designer, he's almost an artist in a way as well, and certainly the way that he works with wood and natural materials, and also local craftsmen, not just with a big player like Schweitzer as well.
Now, I asked him about some of those aesthetic considerations when I caught up with him. Let's hear what he had to say.
I met Bernhard 5 years ago, Bernhard Schweitzer, the owner of the company, and he asked me to design 2 years ago some small furniture for the stand. And this year they asked me to help them to design a little bit the whole stand, the concept, and especially the VIP lounge inspired by the Stube. That's a traditional...
It's kind of like a ski lodge kind of thing, is it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's a warm bit of farmhouse, and yeah, inspired from then. Here we are. In the middle, there's this big table where the chefs are cooking and the whole food.
And tell me about EuroShop. You know, what does this event do for designers like yourself? You know, we're used to seeing your products around. We know your designs. Is it a great forum, something like EuroShop, for designers as well? It's about an aesthetic as well as people who are shop fitters and from that side of the retail experience. It's also a good forum for designers, isn't it?
For sure, it's very important. It's one of the important shop fitting fair, let's say, in Europe, for sure. Many international people are coming to visit it. I think it's a great show and it's a very good fair.
And Harry, tell me about some of the other projects that you're working on. Where will we see you popping up next? What do you have up your sleeve? Any more novel ideas that might take us by surprise, perhaps?
In April is the famous Salone del Mobile in Milan. So I will do the show with 10 other international designers. Tomorrow, actually, I'm going to Veneto to work with other craftsmen together to produce new pieces. Planning to make family house that's in north of Italy.
Fantastic. Well, you're certainly a busy man, unsurprisingly. Just tell us finally, what will you take away, do you think, from EuroShop this year? Is it... Do you feel a lot of positive energy? Is there a lot of optimism in your field of work? Do you think there's still lots of great opportunities here? Or are there any things that concern you maybe a little bit? What's your attitude? Optimistic? Positive?
Very positive. In general, I think fairs are very important to go there to get inspiration or also to see the trends a little bit.
Great stuff. And just finally, when you sort of look at people actually using your pieces and engaging with your designs, what's your sort of emotion?
Yeah, that's nice to see. If people are using your products and they are happy and they like them. If you see a product that you designed somewhere in a shop or somewhere around the world, yeah, it gives you a feeling, yeah.
So that was Harry Tyler talking to me before. Tyler, I guess, yeah, what's the sort of design lessons that you'll take away from EuroShop this year? The triumph of the traditional, perhaps? It certainly seems to be in the air here on Schweitzer stand.
I was rather obsessed with this one very, very tiny stand that I stumbled across. But I thought, you know, if it all went to hell, what would I do? And it was a rotisserie chicken stand. If I wanted to start small, I could probably do 6 chickens at once, but then I could really scale up as well. I mean, you could really go for it, and you could do 50 chickens at once if you wanted to. But I stood there and I thought, you know, this isn't bad. Could you imagine if you had your 4 chicken stand? I didn't ask the price, but I think I might go as soon as we're off air. I think I might sort of run over and get that catalog. I thought one of the really amazing things here is this is also startup heaven, and so oftentimes in media today, tech has really co-opted the word startup. And what I've really loved about walking around the fair for the past 2 days is just at every turn you think, okay, that's an amazing way that you do an apothecary. If I was going to reinvent, you know, what the Apple store would be, this is maybe the company that I would work with. If I wanted to have a new focus on lighting. So, you know, the great thing about walking around this as well is you can have sort of, you know, hundreds of ideas about, you know, launching, you know, your own small scale business. In terms of design cues, you know, I think a multitude, but it's interesting, probably I really enjoyed talking to the chap from Organoid who is on. I think you just liked, of course, smelling all of their different sort of wall panels that they're doing. That was Martin Yehart, a really fantastic gentleman. And so I think also that level of innovation that also a small player like this can come into the mix, and hopefully they'll make a big name for themselves as well.
Absolutely. Those are the insights of Tyler Brulé with me here at EuroShop in Dusseldorf. And with those thoughts, we cross back to London.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Tyler. And look forward to seeing you both tomorrow. Apparently they're both off now for a quick beer before they finally come home. That was, of course, Tom Edwards and Tyler Blay from EuroShop in Dusseldorf.
The menu isn't just about food or drinks, it's about the people with innovative ideas, the ones who savor traditions, and the ones who are willing to go further than most in search of the most delicious ingredients. Whether it's an author who's discovered true adventure through food, or a master bartender traveling the world in search of new and exciting flavors, the menu uncovers the tastiest tales from around the globe.
We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being, but I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity.
As well as going behind the scenes with top chefs such as René Redzepi and Massimo Bottura, we find out the latest in restaurant design, the creative culinary experiences keeping city dwellers' taste buds tingling, and what Japanese clubbing culture and noodles have in common. Join me, Markus Hippi, for the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. And we're coming almost to the end of the programme. And before we kind of head off, time for our daily review segment, where we go through the best in books, theatre, art, music and cinema, not all in one go, with our correspondents and contributors around the world. Today, we talk to broadcaster, DJ and music curator Nick Luscombe, who is also the founder of Musicity, a worldwide music and architecture platform. If you want to know more, you'll have to listen to The Urbanist, because we often quiz him there about his great work. But apparently there's one coming up about Singapore soon. First, today, though, we want to talk to you about a band called Laszlo. Tell us a little bit about them, and then we'll hear a clip from them.
Okay, well, Laszlo is... I kind of became aware of them a couple of years ago, and they've just released a new EP. It's basically put together by a guy called Aaron Wheeler, who has made a lot of TV music, so you probably would have heard his stuff before, actually. He does a lot of really mainstream stuff. But this band, this unit, Laszlo, really kind of shows his sort of incredible musicality, and works as a four-piece, and they're about to play live as well, so it should be fascinating to see them actually do it.
Well, let's hear, this is Limbo Lullaby, and let's hear a clip from this. Did we just play the wrong bit, or is there no lyric in that?
Well, I'm
it was just getting going. Look at me coming back. He played the wrong bit. I knew. It's a terrible thing. They always play the beginning. Look, it's getting all happy now.
This is the bit. This is where it all happens. That was the kind of, the moody intro.
Okay.
And this is the bit,
this is quite nice in the background. Yeah. But I hear, when I look at the reviews, words like minimalist came up quite a lot. And that is quite sparing at the beginning. But is it minimalist?
No, I don't think so. I think it's incredibly musical. I think he's probably the most... Well, it's a bit of a statement, but one of the most musical producers out there, and I think he puts a lot into his work. I'd say maximal. Yeah. Let's go for that.
Okay, so we played the wrong bit and we've read the wrong reviews. Well, apart from that, so this is from an EP, did you say, that's coming up?
Yeah, you're going to quiz me on the name of the EP and I've totally forgotten, but it's on the Lydian label.
So you forget things as well.
Yeah, I do. But I advise people to check it out. Four tracks, all really different, all really good. And there's a lot of kind of Pat Metheny influences in there, quite 80s. And I love it.
Okay, well, let's see if we can do better with the second one. Don't put it on from the beginning. That's the clue. We're going to cross the channel now. And this is a Parisian band, Tin. Band or singer?
It's a singer, a female solo singer. She does everything herself, pretty much. She's produces and sings and plays a lot of the instruments. And again, this is someone that a friend of a friend got in touch about her music. I've never met her, but she's playing in Paris soon. I really wish I could go and see the gig. But I just really like her stuff. It's really good. I think it's very charming. It's got that kind of slightly Francois Hardy kind of style to it, but done with the kind of 80s electro style.
And is there a good kind of market in French pop coming here at the moment? Does it cross
question.
The channel? Because whenever I listen to this stuff, I think, oh, amazing, I love it.
Yeah.
But you never then hear it.
It's it doesn't get played so much here, does it?
Okay.
Which is a strange thing. But it's a tough one, I think,
Well, let's see if we've got something we can play here. It's probably just going to be one single note in the background.
There's a blue hour in your head.
Well, that was the Parisian. We say duo Tin, but is it? She's more on her own, is she?
Yeah, I think production-wise, probably a duo. But I always think of her as being on her own. But like I said, I haven't seen her live, so perhaps she plays with other people.
Maybe she's got some friends.
Yeah,
well,
possibly.
It's called Shady Hour.
Yeah.
We've got one more to kind of fit in before the end of the show, so let's not dwell too long here, because we're off to Oakland. The band Trails and Ways has come up with a great rendition of a song by the Brazilian musician Jorge Ben. This is Taj Mahal. How many countries can we fit into one reference? Okay, well, that's good. Just tell us about Trails and Ways.
Well, they're from Oakland.
Who isn't from Oakland these days?
It's true. I'm going to move there, I think, because I think everyone else is might as well. But they're sort of like, looking at their videos and stuff, they seem to be into hiking and the outdoor life, and they're all about cooperatives. They sound quite hippie, actually, but okay. They're pretty smart kids, I think, and just another great little band I found on Bandcamp.
So Bandcamp, just tell us about Bandcamp for people who don't know.
Bandcamp, American digital download store that sells merchandising as well. It's for me, it's like the similar to kind of going to a great old dusty record shop and finding kind of great music, and, you know, from the past and new stuff. And it's becoming increasingly my source of new music.
And how good a hunter do you have to be to kind of find things on there?
They make it easy. I think they've got some good guys working there, and it's well put together.
It's simple bit doing your job these days, isn't it?
It's easy.
Log on, find the songs.
That's it.
Okay, so who gets your vote out of those three? Go and upset someone. Look at you, you're useless. I'm going to keep the French happy. I'm going to have Tin. That was my favourite. That was poor old Nick. Anyway, thank you very much for coming
on
the show.
Much.
That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our guests at the top of the hour, Daniela Peled and John Owen, and of course to Nick Luscombe too, if he's safe with those bands when he gets out of the room. Today's show was produced by Daphne Denis. I know which band she's going to choose. Researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who's got a Brazilian connection. I know which band he's going to choose. And Christy Roma, our studio manager, was Alex Funnell. Hopefully he'll be able to tune those tracks a bit better next time. Next time, we join Tom Morris for Section D. He'll be assessing London Fashion Week and casting an eye over the shortlist for 2014's Designs of the Year.
So we've got everything from kind of iPhone apps to crowdsourced search and rescue mechanisms, and the furniture is still in there, but it's kind of pales in comparison to some of the digital technology that we're seeing this year.
Stick around for that. Then at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's time to say goodbye to me, for goodbye from me even, and thanks for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.